compared with the factors in front, right? And the factors appear here depend on the factors you put in here. So, and related to that number is if you're thinking of the S matrix being, you know, matrix element of something, then it depends on how you normalize these states too.
Okay, yeah.
And so one thing, you know, in our book, we're using relativistic normalizations, and Weinberg's not.
Okay.
And one doesn't mean more than one, like Weinberg's, because that's what I'm actually used to. But it is true that if you do it the way that Weinberg does, the way that I do, there's some factors of 2 pi that you always have to carry around, and they cancel in the end of the day.
Okay.
And it's kind of, so if you're using the relativistic normalization, means that you're not carrying around factors that are not going to be the answer anyway.
But it seems weird that it depends on the amount of bodies in Weinberg that you're scattering, that you have a factor of 2 pi, and it's not in our case.
So you're talking about the factor here, or you're talking about the factor here?
The factor in front of your delta function, in the S matrix. The key factors are 1, 2 pi in a 1 body problem, and a factor of 2 pi before in a 2 body problem. And he has a formula of like n plus 3 or something like this, or n plus 3 and plus 1, or is factor 2 pi. I guess I can show it to you later.
Maybe that's the thing to do. Is whatever is happening here is canceling here, at the end of the day. And I suspect the 2 pi are related at some level to the states, because there's 2 pi, you know, it depends on how you can fold 2 pi into this normalization of state, depending on if you're box normalizing them or continuing normalizing them, because the sums and Kronecker delta functions in the discrete normalization become 2 pi deltas, and there's a 2 pi for every delta when you do it. And so there's factors of 2 pi that are going to be varied for normalizations of it. And he sets it up using a box normalization, and then he goes to the normalization from that. And that means you're carrying factors of 2 pi. And another factor of 2 pi to watch is whether or not you're keeping track of one delta function of time, energy only, or you're keeping the delta 4 for energy and length. And because it's going to, you know, normally you'd have a 2 pi. You're following this, and if you're following the momentum conservation as well, you've got 2 pi to 4, that would be what you think about. I can't remember exactly which. There is a discussion by Weinberg in some place in the literature where he's doing, you know, if you're doing scattering in quantum mechanics, you normally aren't following momentum conservation because you're really following potential scattering. So you might not observe. And so the T matrix, or whatever you call the thing in front of here, often has a 2 pi because you're thinking of a case where momentum that isn't necessarily conserved.
Yeah.
But all the conventions are being designed so that once you get to the final answer, you're getting the same answer all the time. And that's why you need to be careful. The first time you do it, be careful with normalization of this, because you're trying to make sure that all the factors are giving you the same answer at the end of the day.
Is that an actual case of normalization, is that it's just equal to 1? The inner product is equal to 1?
Sorry, say that again?
Our normalization is that the inner product of 2 states are equal to 1, or is equal to the delta function.
No, so I think Weinberg's continuum normalization would have been, you know, the one that you use in non-relativistic mechanics. And that would have been delta cubed with p minus q prime. What we're using is a factor of square of energy around to make this thing
okay.
Covariant. And I can't remember if we put 2 pi or something like that. The conventions, this is the thing that I dislike about the book most, is that the conventions are not really strictly the one that I use normally. So. But it's pedagogically clear to have fewer 2 pi's running around. So somewhere in there, state theorem.
So Weinberg's round brackets means that it's...
Here we are, yeah. So you go to equation 1.8.
Okay.
There is a 2 pi running around there then. So it's a 2 pi. So we're using 2 pi cubed and twice the energy. So this one is coming from it. That's making it covariant. And this is just that you don't have to keep factors of 2 pi. Otherwise, you would be keeping in all your phase space normalizations, you'd have 1 over 2 pi cubes running around.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just keeping you from doing that. That's probably the one you're thinking about. Because if you have this, every new particle you put in is giving you another factor of square root pi in the amplitude of sub 2 pi cubed to the right.
Question of 5.2.1. There is a teacher.
5.2.1.
So is that a new expression?
The curly F plus T, plus yeah. T, yeah?
Yeah, should it be there? Because after integration, we can find that any F and T.
You're talking about the F and G that are defined right below that equation?
Yeah.
If they have to be there, because otherwise there'd be no matrix element left, right?
So the statistical expression is something after integration of P and P prime and then anything else. So there should be no...
Well, you're wondering why this thing depends on momentum and you've done them in the integral of the angles already. Yeah, it's because the approximations M, what I remember about this is that the thing is you've got a very big nucleus and it's you're doing actually a neutron here, right? So the energy that you release is a, MeV or something, whereas the mass of the whole thing is 930 MeV or something. So the first approximation, the nucleus just sits there in the rest frame. And so the integral you're doing would have been over the final state momentum. And these matrix elements are all to do with the nucleus because it's the proton and the neutron on both sides. And so their dependence on the integration variables is negligible because the nucleus just sits at rest. That involves an approximation where you're neglecting recoil amounts to neglecting energies. Neglecting the momentum of the nucleus compared to the mass of the nucleus.
So if we just choose a S matrix, and we evaluate all the integrals, then we can find something similar to the last four terms, like the electron and the momentum electron.
You mean these last factors, the square roots of things?
Yeah.
That's phase space, yeah. That's coming from the D3P.
Okay, so if we only do the final product, phase space integration, so we can find something for terms.
Yeah, those things are going to come to you. You can kind of almost see them this E squared minus M squared is really the momentum on the other side. And what you've got there is basically a P cubed D3P, which is P squared DP times solid angles. And so but then you divide it by the energy. So you have the phase space is always P squared dP divided by the energy. And what kills is a factor momentum that gets killed by something. I'm missing something here. The square root is basically the factor of P, and then the remaining factor, you're getting a factor of energy times momentum. And I guess what's going to depend on is the matrix element is going to have factors of momentum, too. But all those, the energies and the spirits of energies are all coming essentially from this factor. Modulo, there's a, there might be a power of energy coming from the matrix element, but it's just overall factors of phase space. And the F and the G are coming from the actual matrix elements itself. And the fact that it's coming out of the integral is your question, right? You're asking why is that outside the integral rather than, because you've done the integral over it already.
Yeah, so we then, in terms of, the expands is the matrix, big matrix, and then find these four differences, like energy of electron, moment of electron, energy of neutrino, but so we don't have, after that, we don't have any F and D. But you're saying that you can keep these matrix, so I evaluate it, and then only do the first piece integral and find this. So you find the four terms, and then
yeah, at the end of the matrix element you were evaluating to get this cross section, in the end of the day, for a neutron to go to a proton, electron, and a neutrino, you had in the weak direction around, and you had and this is really a down fork is going to an up fork. This is what's really happening microscopically. So you had some term in the Lagrange which is destroying a down fork. So it was something like up bar, gamma mu, gamma left down. Times W, I guess we've just created W minus, it would be like W star. Then there's another term which will be the electron one. It would be, so we want to destroy and create an electron, so we have to have keep going around gamma Q, gamma left, a freedom or something like that. So you've got a piece like that, the W, and so that you're the W thing gives you the W propagator. That's the 1/W squared you're getting. But at the end of the day, you need to get the matrix element of this thing between the no particle state and the electron antineutrino state. That's going to give you some factors which you can just evaluate. But you had to also do the matrix element between the proton, U bar, gamma mu, T, gamma left, neutron, which you don't know how to do because this is some complicated state, right? It's not a quark, it's a gang, it's a proton. And that's the factors F and G. So F and G are just keeping track of mu equals zero or mu equals space, basically. And since you don't know what this is, you just carry it along in the answer. And that's why it's appearing. It has to be an answer eventually because the whole answer has to be a portion of this thing squared. And it's a sum of terms because this is being contracted with something. It's being contracted with W mu, which is becoming a propagator, which is then contracting it with this thing. So you get a sum of two terms because you've got a gamma zero term and a gamma space term, which were being added because this mu contraction is being summed, you're getting summed in the end of the day. And there's no interference between the two terms is why you get this, at the rate you get a sum as well. So that's where it's coming from. In principle, it's a function of the angle that you're integrating, but in practice it's coming out of the integral because the dependence on those angles is very small because the nucleus isn't recoiling, the nucleon isn't recoiling very much. So you may have to use that the energy released in this thing is much, much less than the mass of the particle that's doing the decaying to drive that last step. Because what that more or less says is that and someone asked, I think you asked for me to bring the assignments in, and I forgot to do it again. But more interesting than me bringing the assignments back will be the solution sets, and so I'll give you the solution sets. The problem is that half of them are done, and half are done for a million years, and there's a couple that were not yet. And so what I'll do is rather than waiting for them all at once, I'll give you the ones that have been done already, so you have those. So that includes this one here. Frankly, I won't give you this one yet. and then the other ones, I'll do them. We're overdue to do those anyway, and I'll bring them as fast as I can. Any other questions? Okay. So you remember where we were? We were doing E plus E minus goes to fermion, fermion bar. And for simplicity, we're taking the case where the fermion is not equal to the electron or positron. Or we've got both of those electrons. And we're also taking that it's not equal to the neutrino, electron neutrino. And we're just doing that because if these two, in these two cases, if this is true, then the graphs that were important were the ones where you basically exchange Z and a photon, kind of the original electron. So we have a but if we had these, so that's in the case, if these are not final states, if these are the final states, we have to be more careful because then we can draw another graph where we have a W boson involved, say, or we cross the initial final states. So, and that case is also done in the later on, but it's this, so we're still looking at the same. And so the bottom line was that there was this great thing that happened. If we neglect the masses of the fermions compared to the Z and the Z mass and the energies involved, because we're thinking we're in the relativistic limit. This is where the energy in the center of mass, let's say, is much bigger than the mass of the fermion or the mass of the electron. Which in practice is not hard to do because if this is a top quark, you have to do pretty high energy. But if for most of the other things involved here, like muon or tau or the bottom quark, the mass involves at most 5 GeV. So once you're above that, then you're in the relativistic limit. And so in that limit, the expression for this amplitude actually simplified a lot, and it did kind of what you physically expected it to do. In this limit that the masses are negligible, you can just set them to zero. But when the masses are negligible, then you have helicity becomes a conserved quantum number. And the interplay between helicity conservation and angular-momentum conservation gave you a simple expression for what the rate was in terms of sums over the various helicities that were involved. And so remember that led to this expression for cross-section, we have d sigma du dt. We're using the Mandelstam variables, which are related to the invariants made of the initial and final momenta, and it had this simple form, which I remember it down here. So it was minus pi alpha squared. And the number of colors for the fermion F. Then we have these A left squared, A right squared. So these amplitudes are all just labeled by the helicity of the incoming electrons, A, and the outgoing fermion. Because if I tell you what it is for the incoming electron, then you also knew what it was for the positron, because the interaction that did the destroying of the positron and electron had specific helicity quantum numbers. Where Aij was just some whatever sine squared theta W cos squared theta W for the Z coupling. The G coupling of the electron, the left or right-handed electron, coupling of the left or right-handed fermion, so that's what I and J are, left or right, divided by S minus NZ times Z squared. And the photon contribution, these things came down to electric charge electron, which is minus one, electric charge fermion, divided by S. And we were looking, and there's a delta function. There. Delta function here, which is delta S plus T plus U. In the limit that we're taking that M squared and M squared are approximately zero. So this in general would be an S plus T plus U minus the sum of the masses, so minus 2ME squared minus 2MF squared. But because this simple form has already dropped things that are proportional to masses. And so for S much less than MZ squared, this you were dominated by the pole here. And in that case, nothing depended on the left or right because the left and right-handed electrons coupled in the same way to the photon. And this had this simple form. The cross-section was diverging for small s. And then if you plot this thing, we looked at if s was smaller than mz squared, but it wasn't negligibly small, we could Taylor expand everything. And the leading term went like 1 over s, and then the subleading term was a constant piece where we had something like 1 over mz squared. And then as s gets close to mz squared, then this thing takes over. And strictly speaking, this formula would diverge. This is mz. And then it would go off, and for very, very large s, everything goes like 1 over s, so that this thing would go like 1 over s squared, and this whole thing would go like 1 over s to the fourth, and it falls off on power. And so you can see that for a very large s, bigger than mz squared, the functional form of this thing is a function of energy coming from electromagnetism in the weakened directions is basically the same. And that's the sign that you've unified them at some level. They're behaving in a way which is very similar to one another. So this 1 over s to the fourth in this expression, which becomes 1 over s squared in the cross section. If it graphed the cross section rather than the differential cross section, it would be 1 over s squared. He said, like you, cross. Because on dimensional grounds, the cross section is going to be coupling constants, which are dimensionless. So it would be something like alpha squared. There's a factor pi there, you can't flip it out. Then this is a length squared, because it's a cross section. And so a length squared is like 1 over an energy squared. And S has dimensions of 1 over energy, and it's dimensions of energy squared. So on dimensional grounds, since we've set the masses to 0, there's nothing else which could carry the units. It has to be S. So we're expecting that sigma goes like 1 over S for large S, and it does. It does once you do these integrals over U and T. So the U integral will do with the delta function. T integral will do explicitly. And nothing here depends on, I lied to you, right? There's a factor that I didn't write. I had the same dimensional argument before that I got wrong. Yeah, I always do that. Start again. So you're trapped in a time warp here, right? I got confused by the dimensions last time. Left, left, right, right have a factor of u squared, and left, right, right, left have a factor of t squared. So let me make sure I write it once. I argued why those things had to be there because those express the angular dependence of the answer. And the angular dependence of the answer, if the electron comes in this way, the plus like that, if the fermion comes out in that direction, the center mass frames are back to back, if that angle here between the electron and the fermion is theta, conservation of velocity together with conservation of angular momentum told you the amplitude had to go to zero if theta was zero or if theta was pi by two. Depending on what the velocities were. And that allowed you to understand why these factors of u and t were there in these two cases. So now if you integrate the u integral, do that with the delta function, the t integral, you just do explicitly because it's all explicitly written here. And the limits of integration for t were 0 and s. So the t integral gives you a factor of s, essentially. So the integral, say, of t squared. Well, let me see if I can get the dimensions to work out. Yes. So on dimensional grounds, you know, the integral over t is going to give me factors essentially s squared. We're going to have things like t squared dt, for instance, right? That's going to give us, or u squared du, but u is now going to become, you know, minus s minus t squared. So we've got something which is of order s squared divided by s squared when we square these amplitudes. That's dimensionless. Sorry, s cubed, because it's a dt. So this has got dimensions of s, and that will take out one of these s's and give us the one of s that you expect on dimensional grounds. But you do that on dimensional grounds anyway. So for the cross section, we're expecting to follow the power here. It does. The cross section here goes like 1 over blows up here, at any rate. So there's an issue as to whether what's happening here. Things blowing up, the perturbation theory, are a bad thing. Cross sections are rates can't get arbitrarily big. And blowing up here is a problem, too. So we have to understand what's going on here. Before doing that, I focused for the last class a little bit on what was happening here. How do you see this particular term? And how do you pick it out of this bigger term? And the way to do that was to look for an observable which depended on, would have been zero if parity had not been violated. We know that the left and right-handed couplings are different here, and that's telling you that the weak interactions are violating parity, whereas the electromagnetic interactions don't. So by looking for a parity of a violating observable to which this doesn't contribute, you have a chance of seeing this term. And so the one I talked about was the left-right asymmetry. That was took the cross-section for left-handed electron minus the cross-section for right-handed electron divided by the sum. Another asymmetry we could have talked about is the forward-backward asymmetry. So if you take to do this, you have to be able to polarize your electrons, right? You have to be able to have a beam of left-handed electrons, right-handed electrons to be able to distinguish in the collisions, and that's been done. People polarize electrons on these wires. But a simpler way to get this kind of a parity violating interaction or observable is called the forward backward asymmetry. And it's something which is available to you even if you can't polarize the electrons. So what you do, you remember in the center of mass, we had the electron coming in, and the final state fermion comes out, and there's this angle theta. And so what we can do is we can define everything in the forward direction as being, you know, everything where theta is bigger than less than pi by 2, bigger than 0, that's the forward direction. And if pi is bigger than theta, bigger than pi by 2, that would be the backward direction. That's also a parity violating. If I distinguish the number of final state particles that come in this hemisphere from this, the difference between those two things is a parity violating choice. So the forward-backward asymmetry is defined to be the forward cross-section minus the backward cross-section over the forward plus the backward cross-section, or the forward cross-section is just defined to be the integral from 0 to pi by 2 d theta of the differential cross section, and the backward one is just the pi by 2 to pi. To do that, all you have to do is be able to distinguish the direction of f. You don't have to be able to polarize electrons. So, if you calculate this thing using only this electromagnetic interaction, will be zero because the electromagnetic interactions don't care about the two halves. But so the first thing you see at low energies below the zenth hole is the interference between these two terms. And there's an expression for this that's given in the book, which is similar to this one, but not exactly the same as this one. This one cares about the difference between the left and right-handed couplings of electron. That one cares more about what the fermion is doing. right. So let's deal with these, you know, when sigma goes to infinity, that's a bad thing. Well, before doing that, though, I also posed you this puzzle that if this is all being done in the limit that the mass squareds are much less than ST and U, and that seems like a very reasonable limit given that the energies involved, these things are proportional to the energies, you know, so the relativistic limit. Remember, S was basically in the center of mass frame was twice the center mass energy squared. T was, did work it out? Let's not work it out. It was basically proportional to the center mass energy squared, 1 minus cosine theta squared. And U was proportional to the energy center mass squared, 1 plus cosine theta squared. Might have a plus or minus reverse, and there's some numerical factors, probably 4 or minus 4. And in fact, it's probably minus 4. The point was that this thing is going like the energy squared. So it's very tempting. The rationale was that if center mass energy is much bigger than the mass, then we can neglect the mass compared to ST and U. But the question was, you know, in this limit, electrons and muons and tau, for instance, are exactly the same particle because they only differ by their mass in the standard model. So if you're doing a calculation in this limit, you should be expecting these things to be exactly the same. And I was telling you that, it's not true if you go to a detector that these things behave the same way in the detector. In particular, the muons, they punch right through to the outside of the detector, where the electrons get stuck on the inside of it. Muons are very different than detector. So there must be some sort of a, and it's still true that this is true in the detector, at least when they turn off. So there must be some sort of a limit of applicability of this approximation that I wanted to think of. And I don't know if anyone's had any thoughts about that. Do you have any thoughts as to why? Why doesn't this work for electrons and muons?
Does it have to do with the electron radiation of the muon? Because this is what happens in the detector. And that's highly dependent on the mass of the particle, isn't it?
So why? If it's relativistic, so what you're saying is part of the answer. So these things, muons penetrate through matter more than electrons do, and when they're relativistic, the dominant energy loss in matter is through bremsstrahlung. And you're saying that it's true that the cross section for bremsstrahlung is very sensitive to mass, but on the other hand, if the cross section for bremsstrahlung is being done in an ultra relativistic limit, why should this approximation fail?
Well, you can't neglect the mass in that case because it's not an additive term. It's that you're dividing by the mass.
So why is that? So that would be an argument why the answer is singular in this limit. So why should things be singular in this limit? You're on the right track, but you're not right. So think about that. That's one of the two classic PhD prism or defense questions. So it's worth having a simple answer to that. And there is a simple answer. All right, so what about when things blow up? And when cross sections go bad, this should be a reality TV show. Things go bad, that means that the approximation you made to get that thing, you know, quantum field theory should have been invented in the Middle East because it's very much in the style of origins from the Middle East. It'll work miracles for you if you follow the rules right at the end, but if you transgress the rules, then you're punished as a sinner. Relentlessly. And so if you calculate things properly in quantum field theory, you'll get everything right. But if you do anything wrong at all, then it'll blow up in your face. And so if you find that something's blowing up in your face, it's always true that if you go back, something you assume has failed. And so in these two regions of the cross-section, something's going on. And the question is, what did you do? What have you been relying on that's failing? Here, I want not to talk too much about, it really is true, the cross-section starts to take off here. And ultimately, what would happen is, you know, that's expressing the long range of the Coulomb force, that the cross-sections, this one over S behavior is something that you've seen. If you look at the Coulomb scattering cross-section that Rutherford found, is very singular in the small angle lip. It goes like 1 over sine to the 4th, theta over 2, or something, right? That's some classic expression. And that's what this is expressing. Actually, that's not exactly what that's expressing. I am lying to you completely. That's completely bullshit. But d sigma dt for Coulomb scattering, on dimensional grounds, that goes like a length squared, so it's 1 over energy squared divided by another energy squared. It should go like 1 over energy to the 4th. And it does. It goes like 1 over t squared. Same kind of argument as this. In that case, if you're scattering, say, electrons from electrons, one of the graphs involves this change of the photon, but in the p channel rather than the s channel. So that graph gives you a 1 over t squared, which is like this thing. This came from this process being ran that way, where you had a photon. But if you're scattering, you're not annihilating things. So this is similar to this in origin, but this is the one that depends on angles, right? If you T is the one that cares about the angles. So one minus cosine theta is up to numbers sine theta over 2. So something going like 1 over t squared is going like 1 over sine to the 4th theta over 2, and that's the Rutherford cross-section that you don't love. So you should believe that there's a growth of cross-sections with these numbers, because it's really seen to happen. But if you literally took it to 0, something has to be going bad on you, because cross-sections can't go to infinity. And what's happening is that for t going to 0 here is angles getting very, very small. And in that limit, what's happening is that for very, very small angle scattering in the Rutherford cross-section, you start to multiply scatter. If you see one electron, and then what's competing with your scattering from one electron is a successive scattering from another electron, or for another electron to screen the first thing that you're scattering from. So there are subsequent processes which are naively down by more coupling constants, which are not down, and the limit of the angle gets very, very small. Which means that this cross-section calculated just using the exchange of one photon is starting to become a bad approximation for small angles. So that's a story which you could talk about, and a lot of condensed matter physics is involved with that story. But this story is what I'm going to focus on, and a similar thing has to be happening here, that there's something wrong with the approximation we're making right at that point, because the answer can't really go to infinity like it does. So, in particular, why does sigma go to infinity and s goes to z squared? It doesn't go to infinity, but it's approximately. Why did the approximation go to infinity, which is to say fail at that point? And what's happening in that case, what's happening in all these cases is that, we're calculating in perturbation theory, and so we're assuming that we're looking at a couple of graphs that involve the fewest vertices. Each vertex costs a coupling constant. So the reason we didn't look at more complicated graphs, in the multiple scattering case, that corresponds to lots and lots of photons going across. Naively, that gives you a smaller amplitude because there's more powers of the coupling constant in the answer. But if there's more powers of 1 over a small angle in the answer too here, then it could be that those two small things are canceling one another, and that's kind of more or less what's happening in this case if you look at very small angles. So you have to ask, is there some other thing in the problem which could be making graphs that you thought were naively in smaller order than perturbation theory not so small as you had thought? So could the argument that higher order graphs are suppressed by part of the coupling constant be failing for some reason? And the reason is a kinematical reason. In the case of small angle scattering, it could be that you did get a small coupling constant, but it's being divided by a small angle. And if the angle happens to be small enough numerically, that the ratio might not be small. We want to know something. Did something like that happen here? And something like that does happen here. If you look at the the bottom line is when cross sections diverge, an approximation is failed, and almost always what it is if you happen to perturbation theory. Higher order graphs are not small. And the important thing is that even though they are suppressed by cup-end cusps. So what would be the problem? What's making the problem here? Well, let me give you an example of a graph which is a problem. So suppose we look at this graph. So we had, I guess, a fermion. Remember, EE, and this could be another fermion. And this is a red, that. Now this is naively, if we're comparing this to this graph. So this one has 1, 2, 3, 4 powers of coupling. This amplitude would be 4 to the e to the 4th, whereas this one is 4 to the e squared. This one has factor of s minus mz squared, because that's coming from the propagator that we had here, and it had the denominator, which was still like s minus mz squared. This has two of those, so it's got s minus mz squared. Then there's something to do with this amplitude here, so there's what we call this. It's called this, I've used A, E. So whatever you calculate there. And then the factors initially and finally are going to be the same as they were, so there's some factors to do with this initial stage, which can be both things. So the argument till now has been that this smallness compared to this makes this negligible compared to that. But you kind of see that there's a kinematical region where that's not going to work anymore. If S is getting close to mz, then so E being much less than 1, so A1 equals A2 makes A1 much less than A2. Unless S minus mz squared is of the order of E squared. If that's true, then if S minus mz squared is of order E squared, then this is order 1, and this is order 1 squared, so they're the same size, essentially, given that B is order 1. So this is something which is, so the danger, the thing to worry about is that if you didn't understand the cross-section here, or here, you could then ask, well, maybe I didn't understand it anywhere. And so if I was using the cross-section here, and I was making conclusions about the left radius symmetry or the floor back radius symmetry, you might say that, well, given that this is not under control here, I have to really go back and say that there's the theoretical error in this whole thing, which I can't understand. So it's important to really understand what's going on here to know that it's not screwing things up here, in addition to understanding what's going on there. And you can kind of see that if this is the problem, that it's specifically a problem in a very narrow range of momenta or energies around here. So that would say that if that's the problem, you can really believe the fact that it's fine. It doesn't go to infinity. At some point, it stops. But you're agreeing that it's going to actually be much higher here than it would have been anywhere else. Because the problem, you'll believe the answer until S minus mz squared is of the order of E squared. And so so when I get to where this is going to go, you'll see how much bigger this is. it's not an infinite, but you'll see kind of an order of magnitude why, or how high it gets. So the first piece of information is that elsewhere, perturbation theory, you know, A2 is negligible. Now, in a case that you are near, you know, when S minus M does squared is of the order of B squared, and there's an extra loop here, so I should really have put in B contains within it a factor of 4 pi squared. I think I did that counting for you before when we were just talking about graphs in general. Every loop gives you a 1 over 4 pi squared if you follow 4 pi's. So how close you get to B, the 4 pi's make a difference because for electromagnetism, E is 0.3. So a series in 0.3 isn't such a great impressive series, but really the series you're doing in electromagnetism is an alpha of 4 pi, which is 10 to the minus, it's smaller than 10 to the minus 2. So those 4 pi's are important. So given there are graphs that are big, the next question is how much big, which are the graphs that we should be thinking about? Because we have to really include all of them in order to really describe what's going on if we're interested in this energy range. And you can kind of see that one class of graphs corresponds to just iterating this over and over and over again. So for S minus MZ squared of the order of alpha over 4 pi, or alpha is squared over 4 pi. Graph. So this is unfortunate. I'll call this case 1, call it case 2. Counting the number of Z propagators. 2 is smaller than 1. 2, 1. And that notation, ace of k is a graph where I have a Z something, a Z something, a Z something, a Z something. So I have a k. That's going to be of the order of, you know, so there's an E squared for every Z propagator. And there's an S minus MZ squared for every Z propagator to the K. And so in this region, there's also going to be a 1 over 4 pi squared for each loop, and there's K of those. So in this region, this is many factors of 1. Not in that region, this is many factors of a small thing. But in this particular region we're interested in, sort of pole, this is something which is as big as what we calculated. So we have to really include it to understand what's going on. And it has this particular class of graphs has a nice property because even though there's an infinite number of them, they can be summed because they have the structure of these amplitudes. It's an iterative one. You're adding many copies of the same thing over and over and over again. So AK is of the form of something E squared over 4 pi, E over 4 pi squared, 1 over S minus MZ squared, times some factor B, which was to do with this loop, to K. And so schematically, if I sum over K poles 1 to infinity of A to K, it has the form of a power of a geometric series. Right, that's going to be, if I'd sum from 0, but sum from 0 would have been 1 over 1 minus, k. Let's call this r of the k. Sum of r of the k times some constant. So it's going to be of the form of a constant. If I'd kept from 0 to infinity, I would have had 1 minus r. But I'm not going to keep the first term, so I have minus 1 here. So it's going to be r. Point is, you can do the sum in this case. And the thing that's appearing, what's happening in the sum is that you're changing the denominator. Because the even though you're summing things in, as a power, once you sum them all, you're getting a change in the denominator here. And so why does that solve this problem? It solves the problem because it sounds like it can't solve the problem. Because why do we have a problem? We had a problem because the propagator had a zero when s was m to x squared. You can imagine that graphs like this could change this. And you could imagine that the graphs that we're talking about could give you something in the form. You know, if this says that the total amplitude, sum over k, so it's always a total. If that's of the form of something, let's call it c divided by s minus mz squared minus v, then that could move the problem, you might worry, because mz squared, if s will no longer be at mz squared, it will be at mz squared plus v is where it will have a problem. So what I'm talking about now is there still an divergence of a total at s equals mz squared plus b c or correspond b. And the answer is no. Why? The reason is that b is not real. When you calculate a graph like this, a loop like that, there's a very general argument that says that it cannot be real. So b is, if you like, it's got a real part, imaginary part. So you can move. It's true that the real part can just you can imagine it being a shift in m sub z. But when you square this thing, the since this is real, there's no way you can make this whole denominator zero because the best you can do is cancel off the real part. The imaginary part gets stuck. So because b minus is not zero, s minus mz squared minus b cannot vanish. Its minimum value will be when you make the real part cancel. When s equal to mz squared. And typically, that's what you define to be the mass squared, the physical mass. So the place that you're going to see this pole here is the place where the cross section is the maximum. And that's going to be not at mz squared, but at mz squared plus whatever this real part is. And if you went back and asked, you know, what does it mean to have a mass for the z particle? Given that you're not actually seeing it leave your detector, it always comes down to the value of what this pole is. This is an example of a more general phenomenon that the mz, we've been treating it as if it was the mass of the z particle. But what it really was, in perturbation theory, we had an action, remember we had a Lagrangian which had the form of there was an unperturbed part and there was a perturbed part. And the unperturbed part had the form of a free z boson. So we had minus 1/4 z mu nu, where this is the derivative of z. And we had minus 1/2 z squared z mu. And what I've been using as mz squared everywhere is just this number that was in the unperturbed Lagrangian. That doesn't make it the mass. It's true that if we did not have any interactions, then it would be true that this thing is the mass, because for the free particle, for a free theory, we diagonalized the Hamiltonian, we found the energy eigenstates, and showed that at zero momentum, the energy of the one z particle state was this number. So for non-interacting particles, we know that this number is the mass. That's why we're calling it mz squared. But really, like everything else, all the energy levels of the system get perturbed once you add the perturbation. And so the physical mass, so the energy of the z particle state at zero momentum, need not be, and generally is not, the value of this number. It gets corrections. And this is kind of one way in which the corrections arise. So you should think of the real part here as being, in perturbation theory, a level shift. If you look at if this was the energy of a z particle having zero momentum, that's what we define to be the mass of the z, physical. If it was this in the unperturbed system, then when we turn on the perturbations, it gets smooth, so that the, so this is a unperturbed, so the free particle. But with the presence of interactions, it gets shifted. So this is a, this is an unreadable graph now. I think it's really good. So this is the interacting energy. What I'm grabbing here is the energy of the Z particle at P equals zero. So this is what would be MZ in the free Lagrangian. And this would be MZ plus delta MZ, including the perturbation. And this is what we would define to be the physical mass. And so the main message is don't think of this mz squared that I'm writing as a physical mass. It's the parameter in Lagrangian that we're calling physical mass, because before we turn the interactions on, that's what it was. Now we're looking at interactions, and what we're finding is that what you should be expecting to find is that the physical mass is not exactly equal because it's shifted from it. And one notion of what the physical mass could be is the where the cross section has a maximum. And that would mean that the physical mass would be this sum. It's going to turn out that notion is the same as this notion, which I haven't shown you. But it's, you see that there's a, you need to define what you mean by the physical mass, and then ask how it's related to the parameters of your problem. And then ultimately, invert, solve for your parameters in terms of the physical mass you measure, and then go off and put it. That's kind of the normalization program. And you're seeing it for the first time. So the bottom line is that V sub R is what's called a renormalization. That's what that means. It's just the parameter we've been calling the mass was not actually physically the mass, except in the free theory. But having said that, even when you're sitting at the physical mass, the imaginary part of this amplitude is not zero. And so now the amplitude is not zero. It's going to be C over B. And so if you want to know the value of this cross-section at the, when you sit at the physical mass, you're going to need to know what B is. So let me write that. So that sounds like that's a lot of work. But there's a general argument that actually tells you that you actually already know what the imaginary part of B is. And that's because there's a general argument based on the integrity. Yes, matrix implies that the imaginary part of B is no, right, it's the mass times the decay rate, where gamma z is the rest frame
former
decay rate. This is the thing we've already calculated. So for the z particle, this was, you know, z squared over 12 pi sine squared theta cos squared theta and g left squared plus g right squared summed over all the fermions times the number of colors, something like that. We calculated explicitly what the k rate of the z was. That thing we calculated is what this is. So what's missing in this argument is that there's a general statement that says that the imaginary part of this of the you know, b was this graph here where we have a loop. The statement was that this loop has an imaginary part always, And then actually a general argument relates that loop to the decay process where Z goes into determinants. So the imaginary part of this is related to the rate for that. And that graph you can kind of see is what I would have thought if I cut that graph, this graph in half. And the reason this connection here is something which you're familiar with quantum mechanics, probably, that if you take so what I'm going to do now is I'll give you I want to show you why, on general grounds, it's true that the imaginary part of a loop graph is related to an actual physical process, which would have happened. You know, what does it say? In this loop, the momenta here were not required to be satisfying that their energy was the square root of p squared plus m squared. They were, you know, off shell, in the sense that we're integrating over all the momentum, and all the energy is independent variables in the loop. But here, for the physical process, these guys really have their energy and momentum related in a physical way. And the statement is that if I look at the imaginary part of this thing, it's related to what I would have had if I were to calculate this thing, where these guys were actually put on their mass shell, so their energy related to their momentum. And there's several ways to think about that. So I want to make a general argument, then I'm going to want to know the factors of two, because we're going to want to know the cross-section. And so I'm going to give you a separate argument for the factors of two, because the first argument I have here is going to be one which you'll see is general, but it's going to be not obvious what the factors of two are. So so what? So rather than giving you one good argument, I'm going to give you two shitty arguments. So the first shitty argument would be, you know, that propagator, you have something like 1 over, so in the loop. You know, where can you get something, you know, what do we have here? We had an integral v4l of some loop momentum, and then we had a propagator for the fermion. Let me just do this for bosons, as if it wasn't a fermion, just to make life easy. If this had been a boson, we would have had 1 over, if this is L, say here's P, this is the L minus P, so we'd have L squared plus MZ, or M, whatever this particle is squared, minus I epsilon, and 1 over L minus P, squared plus M squared, minus I epsilon. And there's some coupling constants, you know, so there's G here, and this is E here. You know, how can this have an imaginary part at all? It has an imaginary part because of these I epsilons, right? Everything else is real. And so, and that's kind of why you had there was a part of the, there's a problem with, the problem we had was when S was equal to mz squared, which is to say that P, the total form momentum going in squared is equal to minus mz squared, and that's when this thing goes to zero. So you can kind of see that these I epsilons are part of the problem. So the first shitty argument is to say that we got something like this. So I want to have a way of writing, I want to know what's the real imaginary part of something like this. So I have x minus I epsilon. What's the real imaginary part of that? Well, the one way to think about this is to, if you had this and you know, how would you find the real imaginary part? What you do is you multiply by x plus I epsilon on the top and bottom, and then this becomes x squared plus epsilon squared. Right? And so the real part of 1 over x minus I epsilon is x over x squared plus epsilon squared. And the imaginary part, 1 over x minus I epsilon, is the epsilon. But what are we supposed to do with epsilon? We're supposed to take epsilon to 0 at the end of the day. Epsilon is just there to, in the integral, you know, we had L squared plus M squared was really the zero component of L squared minus plus the three momentum squared plus M squared. And so the problem was that the denominator had a zero because this term was negative, and so the energy was going to go, the denominator went to zero precisely when the energy was on mass shell, that L zero was equal to the square root of L squared plus M squared. And we were supposed to be integrating everybody, and so the epsilon would just tell us how to do the contour integral, remember? Because it came into us because we had time ordering in the propagator originally. And then at one point, I used an identity for the step function in the time ordering to write it as a contour integral in the complex plane. And it depended on which side you closed the contour, how you express the step function. And so the epsilon is just there to tell you how to close these contours to get the contour ordering right. That's why it's there. But once you've got the contour right, you take epsilon to zero, because the answer doesn't depend on epsilon. So if you think of what happens here, if epsilon goes to zero here, then this just goes to 1 over x. This is sometimes called the principal part of 1 over x. But this is it's a very singular limit here, right? This looks like it's going to go to zero. But it depends very much on whether or not you take x to zero first or epsilon to zero. So if x is not equal to zero, this goes to zero. But if x is equal to zero, then this is 1 over epsilon, and this goes to infinity. So if you integrate this over x, this looks and smells like a delta function, right? It's something which is zero except for one point where it's infinite. And if I can show you that the integral of this thing is one, and if I multiply it by functions and the integral is equal to the value of the function at zero, then you can see that this is a limit that an epsilon goes to zero of epsilon over x squared plus epsilon squared is some number, 2 pi or something like that, delta of x. So what that says is that the imaginary part of these propagators is proportional to a delta function where this thing is equal to zero. That is to say that the energy is the square root of L squared plus M squared, so that these are on a nutshell. Times some known number, 2 pi or 3 or something like that. And so if you're interested in the imaginary part of this graph, it's going to correspond to evaluating the same kinds of integrals, but where you're not integrating the energy momentum independently, you'll be integrating them on the nutshell where the energy is related to the momentum in exactly the way that would have been true for this. The thing that's in the integrand will be g's, as you would have had twice here. And you would, and the thing is, like, the kinematics of this, the rest of the graph, you know, these vertices are exactly what you had for the external lines. You know, that if we had had a fermion here, we would have had factors like, in the numerator, we'd have things like L slash plus M. And those came to us as being spinners, U bar, V V bar, which are being summed over spins, remember. We did it for the W boson. We had some of the polarization vectors, epsilon star, mu and nu, and that gave us eta mu nu plus p nu over m squared. Those kind of things in the numerator are coming from sums over spinners, but those sums are exactly what you would have had here for the external lines, for the fermions. Instead of having a propagator, you would have had external lines, and you would have had things like U bar or polarization vectors. So it really is true that if you take the imaginary part, and you take advantage of the fact that you can express the imaginary part of this denominator because it's I epsilon as a delta function, which is putting the things on shell, that up to a numerical factor, the imaginary part here is related to the rate. So that kind of shows you algebraically what's going on to use one loop graph. But the statement is not just that one loop, it's an exact statement. And that's, you can kind of see from the second shitty argument. So the second shitty argument, this is the shitty argument on the board. I can't remember if I can hide sometimes. So the second argument is, you know, we're looking at the matrix element, some final state, some initial state, square, right? Where S is a unitary operator. And we're writing S as being, you know, 1 minus 2 pi to the fourth I times some, we call it A times the delta function. But let me just call this, you know, 1 minus I t, where t is all outside. And t is basically well defined as long as you have the energies on equal for the initial final state. The main thing is that the amplitude, if beta and alpha are different from one another, squared, you know, that's the beta. So it's delta beta alpha. So you're going to get this thing squared would be delta beta alpha. And then we get minus I times 2 alpha p alpha. Because this thing, when I multiply by each other, this is going to be non-zero only when beta and alpha are the same. And then we'll get this thing squared, which is plus beta p alpha squared. But if I just plug this definition to this, right, this says that this is 1 minus IT plus IT dagger plus T dagger T equal to 1. So the 1's cancel. So that says that I T dagger minus T is equal to T dagger T. So what we're interested in. Actually, I don't know why I showed you this one. This is when the drugs are kicking in. Ignore that line. Now, what we're interested in for the rate, for this imaginary part, is this. If I look at some matrix element where I'm here, if I've got a z on the one side and a z on the other side, let me take the alpha-alpha matrix element of this. We have I times alpha t dagger minus t alpha has to be equal to alpha t dagger t alpha. Can I put a sort of complete set of states here? This is the sum over all states of alpha t n t alpha squared. And this is just the imaginary part of alpha. Up to factor 2. It's probably twice the magnitude, right? So this shows you that what's this? This is what you would have called the optical theory of quantum mechanics. It says that the forward nothing that the amplitude for nothing to happen, the imaginary part of that is related to the cross section for everything to happen, where you sum over all possible things that could have happened. And that's the quantum mechanical thing that's underpinning this argument. That this is the nothing happens limit. This is the same momentum in and the same momentum out, which is momentum plus space can require. And this is the forward scattering amplitude. And we're asking for the imaginary part of that. It shouldn't be a surprise that we're finding that it's related to the rate for alpha going into anything. And it just happens that at one loop, the only other thing that it can happen with one vertex is that it goes to fermion fermion pairs. But if we'd done this to 15 loops, it would have still been true that the imaginary part of the graphs with all kinds of things going on and not just one bubble would have been related to the more accurate calculation for the decay rate of the Z boson here. It's not an artifact of the one loop graphs, which you might have thought based on the first argument. Let me give you the cartoon of the last argument of factors 2 in the afternoon. But you see, the main thing is you see the two messages so far are this, that when you're near, for special kinematic regions, in particular in this case where S is near the mz squared, perturbation theory is breaking down because you have more than one small number on the problem. You don't have just the coupling constant, you have the coupling constant, and you also have S minus mz squared, and they're appearing as a ratio. So that ratio is not small, even though the numerator is small. That's the first thing. There's corners of momentum space which can be, for which perturbation counting graphs like powers of coupling constant can fail. When you're sitting on a pole like this, that's an example where it happens. The kind of things, the graphs that are contributing that are not suppressed anymore are graphs like that. The reason they solve the problem is that they give you an imaginary part for the denominator, and you can never make the imaginary part go away by choosing any value of S because that's real. That means you have to calculate the imaginary part, but the good news is that there's a very general argument based on the unitarity of the S matrix, which says that the imaginary part of this thing is always going to be related in a simple way to the total rate for the thing that was this boson that was appearing to decay. And so what hasn't been straightened out yet is whether is the factor of 2 in that expression, the imaginary part of B is equal to mz. But I'm going to claim that the right answer here is to have minus mz squared minus I gamma z mz. And if we just use the cross-section we've been using until now, but use this as the amplitude rather than this, then we have an answer which actually works also in the vicinity of S equals MZ squared. Because the thing that's appearing here is the thing that had to be there because of the general unitary argument. So it includes the contributions of these graphs that were not negligible and were not included in the calculation that we had done before of the cross-section. But it only kicks in, you're only supposed to trust this term in when this is the same size or less. If you're in a regime where S is bigger than MZ squared, I can Taylor expand, this is of the order of alpha. And so if I were to try and work for S in a region where S is not near MZ squared, I have to Taylor expand this and neglect this because this is an order of alpha correction, which is the same size as all the other graphs I didn't calculate, which are also order of alpha correction. So it only makes sense to keep this if I do that in the region where S is near MZ squared. So the only thing that changes is instead of going to infinity, this thing gets capped off. And it gets capped off by an amount which is order of 1 over alpha bigger, because if this is 0, and this alpha here is making the amplitude go like 1 over alpha. So you get a resonance, but it doesn't go to infinity. And the only thing that's changed by this argument is what's going on here. But everything up here, you can ignore this because it's the same size as things you've already collected. So the only thing you're missing now is why is it a 1 rather than a 2 or a 6 or a 4 pi? And that's the next thing I'll show. And I'll use a third shitty argument to show that rather than that on its own. Okay?
It's just about the sign. So aren't there supposed to be factors of 1 over n factorial for each of the k's, or 1 over k factorial for each of the k's, based on the expansion?
Oh, the Feynman rules. Yeah, but there's also factors of statistical factors of how you connect them all together.
So they all cancel each other. All the factorials will cancel each other.
For this class of class, perhaps, yes.
Okay. And secondly, that expansion or the geometric series is only valid when r is less than 1, right?
Right.
That's not when s is close to 2, but it's not less than 1 anymore. It's just sort of a technical point, but I can see how this is.
You're worried that S is
like you're saying S goes close to MZ and then it becomes of order 1, so it's slightly less than 1, and you can't do the you can't take first order, but when it becomes greater than 1, then you can't do that sum, right?
No, that's true, you can't strictly do the sum because sum doesn't converge unless R is less than 1. So then
is this just a cartoon that, like, it's just this isn't a formal derivation of it, or?
This is partly a cartoon. The honest calculation is really the unitary calculation.
Okay.
But if I wanted to really persist with the cartoon, then what's really going on is that you can think of this as you can do the sum if R is bigger than 1, it's just you have to, there's a really great book called Divergent Series by Harvey, it was written 100 years ago. And it's like the normalization before anyone has to figure out field theory. And he makes the point that he's interested in doing things like sum n equals 1 to infinity of 1, or r to the n or something like that. So things that are divergent. And when can that make sense? And what he shows is that so the way you might define this is you might define this by not actually doing this calculation. You could do a calculation like with e to minus n over l or something like that, and then take l to infinity or something at the end of the day. And so you can find this to be some converging sum which depends on l, and then take l to infinity. And in some ways of doing that, if you just naively did this, you just get the answer to diverge. But you can sometimes end up with this answer actually converges once you've done it. In a way, I'll show you in a second. And so what he shows you is that what you're really doing is you're saying the sum you want is the convergent sum. You're defining it to be some regulated sum. And so now you're kind of worried that we could all choose different ways to define the sum, and so would we write? And he shows this one central result, which is great, that as long as your definition satisfies these two reasonableness criteria, and the reasonableness criterion is that I take a regulated way of defining a sum, and I apply it to a converging sum, I get this sum. So if you have that property, and if you have a linearity property, that if you give me the regulated version of a sum of two sums is equal to the regulated version of each one separately. I think that's it. If you have those two properties, then any two definitions of these sums have to agree. And what you basically do is you show that the if you give me two ways of regularizing that satisfy this, I take your difference, and that's a converging sum because it's termwise zero. Right? But then because of this linearity property, that means that our definitions are going to agree to have zero. That means that our definitions agree because the difference is zero.
So essentially, is renormalization.
If you did this for integrals, that's more or less the fundamental normalization. That you could ask, there's 50 million ways to regulate integrals, why don't you care? And it's because the difference is always something which is a disappearing normalization. So it's the same argument that's going on as here, but if you're relying on this, basically it's linearity property of normalizations. So one way of defining a sum is to define it as analytic continuation of the complex plane for R. So in the complex R plane, in the unit disk, you can just do the sum. And so in the unit disk, the sum is equal to 1 over 1 minus R. But now this is an analytic function, and this is an analytic function. And so what I'll do is I'll define them up here to be the analytic continuation of this, and that's the unit for an analytic function. And so that will be a way of defining a sum for R bigger than 1. And so that's one way of thinking of making sense of this whole thing I just already told you there. But you know, when push comes to shove, the real reason you believe it is this general unitarity is that you really know that these amplitudes have imaginary parts, which as you get close to the imaginary part, it's related because of a very deep physical argument to the rate of the part. Any other questions? Right, see you at the